On this episode of Mex and Men, Max passes the baton. Alana gets a sinking feeling while meeting her biggest fans, and Blake's wisdom might be unquestionable, but Mindo might have a point. This is Of Mechs and Men, a Battletech book club. I am Kanan Hill, joined, as usual, by my two good friends, Brent.
It is me, Brent.
And Aaron.
It's me, Aaron.
How we doing, boys?
Well, I didn't just talk to a bunch of Comstar percenters and tell them that Jerome Blake didn't predict something, so I think I'm gonna be okay.
Well, that's good, because this week, we're covering chapters 16 through 18 of the book we've been working through.
Warrior Coupe by Michael A. Stackpole.
Let's get into it.
Chapter 16. We are back on Sion. It is the 17th of May, 3029. And, well, first, we get a speech by the Chancellor, right? All right, we get this scene. It's like you get a shot of the Chancellor. It's like a news camera feed, right? I feel like originally, and it's just, it's like Max Liao, and it's like a press conference. He addresses the citizens. Oh, you know, it's been a long time since I spoke with you, but you're always in my heart, etc. People of the Confederation are always in my mind. Thank you for your sacrifices and whatnot. It's funny, though, at some point, it like zooms out, and you realize that Justin is like standing there next to him. Well, it's funny, actually, the chapter is from like Justin's perspective. It starts with him. He's like standing just off frame, but he's in like they have like the lights on him, and you just see him like standing there, and like the Chancellor's next to him, and he's just like trying to look forward, and like the Chancellor's going on, and he's like sweating, like it's like the lights are hot.
Yeah, Max Liao isn't doing as good of a job as Hans did during his press conference. I think there's a line in here where Max is talking about like, if you're feeling fear, that's the equivalency of treason. So don't be afraid, because we're going to win this war.
It's just another hashtag Capellan moment.
Like, is war scary? That's treason.
He is just like, a bunch of bad stuff has happened to you, probably, because of my action. But it would be wrong if you were mad about it. You quickly realize, though, that this is actually like an award ceremony, right? For Justin, because he's just returned from the Bethel raid, right? Justin's back from the Bethel raid. He just got back. Everyone's very excited. It was successful. They're throwing him a party. Justin receives the Baton of Illustrious Service, right? The BOIS. The boys stick.
The boys award.
Right? He gets this stick. Oh, and we learn shortly after he's also receiving a land holding. He's to be made Shanso of Ting. So like he's nobility now, right? He's titled. He's getting a title.
Which is a lot nicer than a baton, we're being honest.
Yeah.
But, and that would be the equivalent of a count, correct?
I'm going to say yes, because I didn't look it up, but it sounds like you did.
You're right. I did.
Oh, Shanso is the equivalent of like a count?
Yes.
Okay. I like after Justin gets his award, the Chancellor goes on to continue talking. And it's funny, like, this is where Justin's kind of standing there next to him. And, Candace comes over and, like, kind of, like, tries to pull him away. Right? Like, come on, let's get out of here. Right? And he's like, what? You know, I wanted to stay and listen to the questions. And she's like, but you wrote the question. And he's like, you know, good point. Right? Yeah. Candace wins.
I do like we get this little peek. I feel like it's a bit implied that some of the questions in the Davion press conference were kind of pre-established, or there was at least some kind of, hey, make sure to ask me this question. Again, alluded to, there was nothing in writing that said that happened. But here we have clearly in this Capellan ceremony that the press are kind of mandated to ask specific questions. For the sake of the story, it's very overt how much the Capellans control the press.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Because crucially, yeah, it is worth noting that like Justin wrote all the, it doesn't say like the topics or anything. It says the question, right? Yeah, Justin prepared the press's questions for them. And so his work is done here. And Candace drags him away.
Really twisted his baton.
No, she's going to do that later.
She expresses her desire to do so, right? And, and he complies. And so she takes him to this corridor, right? They're in the palace. So she's like, come on, let's get out of here. And they're walking down this big hallway, the grand corridor, a grand corridor. It's beautiful, palatial estates. The exterior wall was made of glass. Oh, yeah, providing a view of the capital city. That's cool. It's a big glass corridor. Anyway, there's these portraits of the royal family on the walls, right? And this is where we notice the mourning ribbons. Mourning, like M-O-U-R-N, like grieving. Mourning. There are ribbons on the portraits of Elizabeth Leal, that was Maximilian's wife, and Tormano Leal, his son. Now, okay, right, this is where I wanted to mention that we wanted to bring up that we totally missed.
It was a subtle remark on Romano's behalf, and we didn't hit it then, but now's a good time, I think.
Yeah, it was a couple episodes ago. It wasn't last episode. It was like some, when we talked about Sen Chong went to go talk to Romano in her room, right? You know, they live together, and that's when he like shredded the couch or whatever with his claws.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had mentioned it then. We like, it's just so funny. We were listening to the episode. And we were like, wait, we totally meant to say that. It was just one of those things where
we had highlighted the notes and everything.
She mentioned, so we know already that Romano has admitted to killing the chancellor's wife, Elizabeth.
At least admitted it to the readers, not necessarily to anyone else.
Right. Actually, was it in italics? Was it her thoughts? Because I don't even think she said, you're right. We know. The reader knows. However, when Justin sees these ribbons, he asks Candace about it, and she explains that Elizabeth's body was found brutally murdered. Remember, like Romano remarked, like, oh, I'll throw you in a ditch like I did the chancellor's wife or whatever. Yeah, she just, she had her killed and dumped somewhere and they found her body.
And again, she previously had admitted to matricide. She killed her own mother as well. So, I mean, we kind of already knew. And by kind of, I mean, it wasn't even heavily implied. It was a giant trout we were slapped across the face with over and over again on how terrible Romano Leal is. So this is just another one to add to the books. Oh, another tally.
The Romanized letter A had been carved into her forehead. Yeah, okay. So she even had, she did a whole scarlet letter thing. Very dramatic.
It runs in the family.
Yeah. Oh, this is where, all right, because there was ribbons on Elizabeth's portrait and Tormano's portrait. Remember, that was Max Leal's son, Tormano. They've mentioned him before. I think that we know, the reader, that he was captured by the Fed sons.
Yes.
However, they don't know.
They believe he's dead.
Yeah, they think he's dead, but I actually think he's like literally hanging out on New Avalon, like having a good time, right? As far as I think they've said somewhere, he's like, nah, he's chill. Yeah, he posted up. Nah, he's not dead. It's very funny. But yeah, this is where Justin's asking about. We get some background information on some, you know, Liao family stuff here. Justin's asking her about her brother, Tormano, right? Yeah, the CCAF reports that he died on Algol. However, Candace doesn't think Justin would have liked him anyway, right? He's just like a bratty rich boy kind of a thing. He married he married like a lowborn. He married a commoner out of like, you know, probably desire for scandal. He's always been, you know, very dramatic, attention-seeking. You know, he's some bratty rich boy.
It is funny that it came out of this desire for Justin to kind of be like, you know, I think I would have probably liked the guy, like,
yeah.
And Candace just shut him down and was like, no, you don't understand. No. He was just slightly better than my sister.
Yeah, I do like when she mentions, like, he just married a commoner because it was to be rebellious or whatever. And Justin's like, is that why you like me? And she's like, well, technically, she's like, you're getting a land grant. You know, she's like, you have a title now. But also, you know, you weren't like a nobody. It's funny.
Yeah, Justin was trying to be more humble than he could get away with.
Yeah, but yeah, she, you know, points out like, I mean, you're not exactly a nobody, right? Yeah. She's like, aren't you Quintus Allard's son? And he's like, oh, yeah.
The Quintus Allard son that works directly for my father? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Justin still thinks he's living the life he lived back on Solaris, slumming it.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, this whole thing is Candace is trying to get her boyfriend back to her place, right? And she's just kind of dragging him along. And, you know, along the way, of course, you know, economic storytelling, right? On the way to, you know, Netflix and chill with Candace, we get some background on the Liao family. Isn't that nice?
And their murders.
and their murders, or lack thereof, assumed. So then we get a little time skip. We get the scene where they're in bed, and she's looking at where he was shot, and she's like, oh, it's like not as bad as you think it would be. She's like, wow, it's like not even that bad. He explains that, one, the jump ship, that, or like one of the jump ships he was using on his circuit, or like the one that was waiting for them on Bethel, had like a helium leak, and it delayed them. And because of this, the medical staff was able to operate on him in like a more like detailed fashion than they would have if they would have to jump immediately, right? And also because they knew that it was some kind of bio lab or something, there was some sort of material, they had some like scientific staff with them that were able to culture like skin grafts and such. Basically, it was quite fortuitous that Justin, he would have been scarred worse, but you know, the stars aligned and it turns out that they had some guys with them and those guys had the time. He's going to be all right. It doesn't even look that bad.
He specifically states that they're research scientists and he's like, you know, next time I think I would avoid having them work on me, but they were the best I had on hand at the moment.
Oh. Yeah, I think there's a bit where Justin like asked the guy like, oh, can you do that? And the guy's like, basically like, buddy, if you were a rat, you know, yeah, probably. Because it's just like a scientist, right?
Yeah. I can't make any promises for a human.
Oh, yes. Luckily, the 4th Tau City Rangers had a real doctor with them who supervised everything. Okay, so that's good. Candace, she's very happy to be reunited, right? Because, you know, she didn't know if he was going to come back. And he almost didn't because of Ling. Oh, right. Speaking of Ling, it's interesting to note that Justin, the text points out, Justin does not tell Candace the truth about her sister's agent being the one to shoot him, right? He decides, he's like, you know what, we don't need to deal with that right now. Right, it'd be a whole thing. We'll just keep it between me and Alexei. That could set off a whole thing. It's very funny. He's just like, he's talking.
Things are already on thin ice, you know, around the throne room of the celestial wisdom. Let's not add any more.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to give our boy Justin a point of credit here because he took a moment to not be extremely dramatic in an inappropriate time. So, you know, a little growth from him here.
That's growth. Yeah, that's growth.
The question is it growth or has he always been capable of it? And maybe the dramatic flair really just part of his spy skills.
It's an act. So Candace asked him about the package, right? Did you deliver the package? Remember her little hollow disc with the St. Ives, the one he got shot over before Alexei saved him? And yes, he's happy to report that, to his knowledge, the package has been delivered. So, you know, the plan is still on, which is Candace sent a message to Hans like, hey, you know, I don't hate you. You know, we can be, you know, I'm the Duchess of St. Ives and I, you know, I have no problem, you know, and my sister, I don't even like my sister, you know, or my father, really. You know, call me, like, basically.
We love what you've done with the whole Tikhonov area.
It looks great.
If you've got any design ideas for our side of space, let us know.
Yeah. I do like there's this bit where Candace wants to reward Alexei, and Justin suggests making him a Mandarin on Warlock, right? And I remember I was like, oh, Warlock is in Candace's holdings. But then Candace is like, oh, no, we should make him, you know, a noble on your planet so that he can work for you. And I don't know. I just thought that was funny. I'd be a Mandarin on Warlock. That just sounds cool. What's the equivalent of Mandarin? Does anyone know that one? I don't. I didn't look it up.
No.
Don't ask me.
Yes, I believe that's the equivalent of a Baron.
It is here that they are interrupted, right? We get some guy starts knocking. There's like a servant knocking at the door because, you know, Justin has been summoned by the Chancellor. We get a real like, oh, you know, this had better be good kind of a scene, right? They're both mad. Justin and Candace are very mad about it. Like, we told you to leave us alone. It's like, but the Chancellor, my lord. And he's like, I got to put my pants on. And so
it actually seems like kind of serious. They're kind of like, go away. And then they're like, well, we can't. It's the Chancellor. And then two death commandos escort them to the briefing room and kind of like, okay, what's this about?
Death commandos, right? What's going on, right? We go to the briefing room, right? We've been here before with the cool, like, they have the cool holo map with the, like, you know, the borders on it and everything has like different colors and stuff. And we, you know, you can see all the different waves that they've launched and all of the territory that Davion has taken, mostly is what they're looking at. So right away, Justin notices that House Davion has launched a fifth wave, right? Another one. Am I right? It's, a fifth wave. They weren't sure if they would. I think they were like, he probably will. But they weren't sure how aggressive he was going to be. However, it seems like pretty aggressive, right? He's taken...
They didn't believe he had the logistics to really pull it off.
Yeah, I believe it's when they were talking about the Bethel raid that they were like, yeah, he's nowhere near ready to launch another wave, so it's a great time for us to attack.
That's right. Man, Hans didn't do what you expected. That's wild, bro. You know? Sheesh. So, yeah, they're getting messed up. A whole bunch of planets. Matsu, Zarak, Menkib, New Macau, Mandate, the classics. Oh, and also, Davin's landing, like, legit combat, like, assault forces on planets that are defended by, like, militias, like, state militia type of situation. So, he basically, there's, like, we're about to lose a bunch of more planets, is, like, what's about to happen, right? We are in the process of, once again, seeding a non-trivial amount of territory to House Davian. You know, wow. Who would have thought?
But there's something a little bit more shocking amongst all these.
Right. It is at this point that Justin notices that the map seems to indicate that Davian forces are landing on Sarna. What? Sarna? Huh? This is immediately he's like, no. Right? When he sees Sarna, he's like, not Sarna. And yeah, dude, Sarna. It's funny because it is like most shocking to us, really, the reader. Like it hits us the hardest. Justin's like, what? Not Sarna. But like, we're like, oh no, not Sarna.
Not Sarna.
Not yeah. Sarna, dude.
Well, for two reasons, right? If you recall, one, this will trigger an interdiction. More on that later. And two, Justin specifically left a certain unit there.
Yeah, yeah, Max immediately reminds him. He's like, why are you concerned about Sarna, Justin? You were the one that anticipated this attack.
Yeah, it is funny. Justin's like, oh no, not Sarna. And then Max is like, didn't you literally put a crack unit on Sarna specifically because you anticipated this? Justin's like, oh, right. Yeah, I did that. He did, though. He like worked out a code. It is funny where, I mean, Justin, I don't think he wasn't sure about, because he put them on there because he wanted to kind of like give them something to do. This certainly gives them something to do.
Yeah.
But yes, also crucially, I think one of the last times we hung out with Comstar, remember, they were talking about Sarna and you're like, man, Mendo's going to love this. Right? That's the first thing as soon as you're like Sarna, like you're like, Mendo! Oh, she's going to be so happy. And right, I'm just so mad about it.
I don't know that we said it though. The unit on Sarna is Big Mac. It's McCarran's Armored Cavalry. There's some big wig. As we mentioned before, they're a very crack mercenary company that's borderline not mercenaries. They pretty much, they're borderline a Capellan unit, but still maintain their independence, kind of. And so if Hans has any hope of winning, hopefully he sent a real A team to Sarna. Otherwise, this is probably going to be a real short trip for them.
He certainly sent a team. So House Davian has attacked Sarna. However, the Chancellor is not very worried about it because McCarran's is on Sarna. McCarran's Armored Cavalry. The Chancellor does, however, believe, though, that this signals kind of an overextension, right? That's his, like, don't you see? He stepped too far this time and he'll pay for it, right?
Which, as the reader, should make you go, wow, did Hans do this on purpose? Is this another trap of the fox? It's also what the Chancellor should be thinking.
Yeah, but so far, we haven't seen any of that from him.
Yeah, the Chancellor's just happy to maybe be able to squeeze one in on him.
Listen, the chapter ends with, Liao smiled cruelly. Hans Davian does not realize it, but he has overextended himself. This attack is the beginning of the end for House Davian and conquest of the successor states. And
I like, it. You got real Darth Sidious with that one.
I feel like he's like clutching. That's yeah. And then we do a fade out and he's like, this is the end of House Davian. And then that's it. That's the end of the chapter. It's they basically at the end of it, there's a chapter about Justin getting that baton.
Yeah, got his boys award.
Hanging out with Candace, and then Davian attacks Sarna. But yeah, this is exciting. We're going to invade Sarna. We're getting, you know, Sarna's getting invaded. I think, you know, McCarran's is there. I don't know. I don't think they say what unit, what like Davian unit is attacking Sarna. But I don't know. We're going to have a showdown, right? This feels like the culmination of something.
And with that, we'll have to find out how everything's kicking off in Sarna in the next chapter.
Chapter 17. We are on Sarna. It is the 27th of May, 3029. Okay, so 10 days after the last chapter. So this chapter opens with, well, first of all, it's from the perspective of the Fed Sun's forces, which, and actually from this, like, it's mostly told from this specific character's perspective, right? Captain Alana Damu. Okay, she's the commander of some forces. We learn shortly that this is the 5th Syrtis Fusiliers, a Capellan March unit, right? This is the 5th Syrtis Fusiliers. This was one of Duke Michael's favorite units, right? They've been mentioned before, so now they're on Sarna.
Yeah, these are some of Duke Michael's boys. That should be a red flag right off the bat.
Yeah, well, this was the unit that Morgan wanted to link back up. He asked permission to, and specifically, Hans was like, I don't want you getting in with that crew.
Yes, they'd be a bad influence.
So it's interesting that they're the ones that are quote-unquote overextended. That is all.
So it's funny because the chapter, it's like the whole start of this is Alana landing and just like being mad about that they've landed in a swamp. You know what I mean? That they're like in a marsh. That she's like, really? This is, why are we? It's like the whole first part is all of them complaining about how their like insertion point is suboptimal. Right? They're like, this sucks. We're mechs in a swamp. We're like looking out over this mountain valley, right? What is this? It's very marshy, stretching out, like breaking into mountains in the distance. The way south is open, but it's like very, Alana doesn't like it, right? Basically, we get this whole bit. She's looking around at the terrain. She's like, this sucks. I would never have picked this. You know, what idiot picked this spot? There's a whole bit where they're talking trash about their like commanding officer, like, oh, Heart of Stone must have threw a dart at the map or something to pick this spot. And
it's suspicious.
Yeah, there's this whole, we get a little like background here where it's like, oh, Tamara Hasek is the figurehead, but like this guy, Colonel Heartstone, right? I don't know, we get this whole bit where they're just like, it's cool. They're just kind of like getting in position and just kind of like complaining. It has this tension to it, right? Because you realize they're like, all right, let's get moving. Everyone, you know, let's take positions. Let's get someone over the hills. Let's figure out what's going on. We're going to be all right.
Yeah, the first thing they do, they're like, all right, well, this sucks, but let's send out some feelers and figure out what we've got to work with.
Yeah, and it said that it's at this point that you realize that this is like a horror scene, right? Because there's just been this tension the whole time, right? You're just like, what's going to happen? Yeah, this is actually a horror movie.
Well, it's set up by the last chapter, right? We know there's a monster here waiting for them, and its name is Big Mac.
Yeah, and then you pair that together with this whole first part of this chapter going like, oh, this is a mess. Like, good thing we're not going to fight any resistance here, because if we were to encounter any kind of fighting force, we would be in trouble.
Yeah.
Seeing how we're like stuck in a marsh.
It adds tension at the beginning where it's just them kind of like hanging out and feeling uneasy, right? For the beginning, you get this and you learn about these characters really quickly. They're like, oh, they're like, there's these professionals kind of bantering. Oh man, where'd the colonel drop us here? It's like, I don't like it. You know, get over the hill. And then it's like, deet, 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 deet. I got bogeys. It's like, what do we got? And like coming through the forest, Savannah Masters, right? A swarm of Savannah Masters. And like everyone starts sweating.
So, you know, mechs are good at a lot of things, right? The fact that most mechs are bipedal is an advantage, right? Because you look at a tank and tanks can maneuver over lots of different types of terrain, but there's also plenty of terrain that they have lots of difficulty with. And so in a lot of ways, the battle mech was an improvement on the tank in that the legs of a battle mech allow them to move over more hazardous terrain. But legs aren't great. If anyone's ever had the pleasure of exploring a swamp as a kid or even going down into like a muddy creek bed in one's backyard, I wouldn't say that legs are the best tool for maneuvering over such terrain. However, what is often used in this case, especially it's kind of iconic in places like Louisiana and South Florida, down in the Everglades, they use hovercrafts. And well, that's what the Savannah Masters are. Their Savannah Masters are, well, they're very efficient hovercrafts, and they're in a swamp, and the battle mechs have legs and the Savannah Masters don't. So we're starting off on, shall we say, the wrong foot already. I guess we have to go into the Savannah Master now Anyway, but the Savannah Masters, they're built around the medium laser. Again, a very efficient weapon. They specifically have a single Defiance B3M medium laser. They ride over this layer of air, and there's a funny thing that the name Savannah Masters actually comes from, it's a bit of a dig at a mech warrior that was used to test against these hovercraft in particular, the Savannah Masters. It was a mech warrior by the name of Savannah Johnson.
When you say battle testing, was she fighting the experimental hovercraft or was she driving it? You're saying that this was, this woman's name was, what'd you say it was? I didn't know any of this. This is interesting.
This test pilot, Savannah Johnson, whom, as it's kind of obvious, the hovercraft was named after. So Savannah Johnson was this Lyran Commonwealth Armed Forces veteran, and she was used in testing with this experimental hovercraft, and she was a Locust pilot, and she helped test the prototype, and oddly enough, the pilot of the prototype was the president of S.L. Lewis Incorporated, which would be a one Samuel Lewis. People who are aware of the history of the Battletech property will recognize Sam Lewis as one of the early, I believe, line developers.
Oh, right. Sam Lewis. Yeah, his name's on everything. Yeah.
Yeah, so the president of S.L. Lewis Incorporated ended up being the training pilot for the to-be-named Savannah Master. And in all of the trials against this Locust pilot, Savannah Johnson, the hovercraft won. And now all of these were done in kind of a simulation where they weren't using actual weapons fire, but the training exercise kind of escalated into a full-on duel. It got a little out of hand, I guess you could say, and I'm assuming Savannah Johnson snapped, and they started actually fighting, and still the Savannah Master came out on top. And so that's actually where we get the name Savannah Master, because the hovercraft was the quote-unquote master over Savannah Johnson. Long story short, just to say that these guys are they're very efficient fighters. They have a lone medium laser, and I would argue one of them may be a threat, given the certain terrain clearly can be a threat to, say, like a light mech. But really, the Savannah Master is most frightening in numbers, right? And in maneuverability in certain terrain. One of those terrain types, that being a swamp. And so these guys in numbers, kind of moving quickly, they're going to be a nightmare for a force of battle mechs that are forced to kind of slog through this mud. So things are looking grim already.
Oh, you know what's funny? Savannah Johnson is one of the notable mech warriors for the Locust in the Wreck Guide Ill Clan. She's the Savannah.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. Yeah, she's listed in here. Cemented in history for losing her reputation, career, and name to a 5-ton hovercraft.
Well, I hope I don't lose enough times in a row in Battletech that they name a unit after me.
One of the most prominent Locust pilots in Battletech, known for getting destroyed by this Savannah Master. He destroyed her so hard. He's like, was this? That's so funny. I thought it was Savannah, like the geological feature.
Right. That would make sense, right? A hovercraft. It likes wide open terrain.
Yeah. When I played Mech Commander, I was like, oh, it's Savannah Master because it's like it operates well in grassland. And they're saying, no, it's actually this other thing. And wow, that's great. That's nuts, dude. I love this.
So these things are real scary, because the way you win fights, battles, wars, etc., is shoot, move, communicate. And the movement here is a problem for them. And as we'll see, other parts of kind of that Holy Trinity are going to start falling apart as well.
Dude, this scene's so cool. They start with the appetizer, right? They get these. I love the dread of it, right? So now, and that was a good pull with that Savannah Johnson. That what a deep cut. Because, yeah, we've established that these things are terrifying. The Savannah Masters, right? All of a sudden, it is. It's like this. It's like fear, right? We got Savannah Masters on radar, and everyone is like, oh, no. It's just so funny that, like, when these hovercraft first show up, they're like, associated with, like, you're, like, taught to be afraid of them. Like, right away, they're like,
yeah.
Yes, like, mech warriors fear the Savannah Master. And they're like, no, not Savannah Masters.
It's true as in real games. It's a common thing for people to mess with inexperienced Battletech players by, you're like, oh, we'll bring like 5K Succession Wars era lists. You know, they'll bring like a Lance, and then the other guy will show up with, an entire unit of Savannah Masters, and they're going to most often win on efficiency alone. I'm sure that there's plenty of listeners out there that have all kinds of horror stories about Savannah Masters on the table. I do like the verbs they use, though. You're right about how they kind of make these things seem terrible. One of the verbs in particular that stood out, they're the craft skittered. It's like the illusion that they're like these spiders in the swamp, like skittering around.
Yeah, they're just getting swarmed by these things. And we get this sick battle scene, though, right? It's like, because Alana, she's an evictor, right? I don't know if I said that. And she's like, no, it's all right, guys, we got this. Let's take him down, open fire. And the evictor, she like has jump jets, right? And she like jumps up in midair, like faces downward. She gets lasers on one of these things. It's just this sick battle scene between these hovercraft and these mechs, dude. And the mechs get like messed up, though. We see a bunch of the Savannah Masters. They like swarm the Orion. Oh, like we get... The Orion explodes one with the LRMs and like, you know, explodes. And we got a grasshopper here. Right. Yeah. The grasshopper gets one with like a large laser, you know, slices the large laser through it and like explodes the cabin.
Wait, this is the first grasshopper, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know.
We're going to save the grasshopper for another book. I think there's a cooler grasshopper scene that is not going to be too long from now. So we're gonna put this one back in the mech bank.
The mech bank. Oh, yeah, we get this cool shot where, like, the hovercraft, like, you know, they're swarming the Crusader. They're, like, getting them with the lasers. You know, you feel like they're just swarming you, like, stinging you, like, zzz, zzz, like, ah, ah, you know, little, like, all your little readouts are flashing, dee, 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 you know, and they're just, like, pink, like, plinking away at you. You know what I mean? And you can't turn, like, fast enough to get at them, and you feel like they're just like swarming around all around your legs and stuff. They vaporize like three of his heat sinks, right? Someone like, ow, you know, just lasers in there, like, tsh, like, you know, all your stuff starts blinking and like alarms going off and stuff. Oh, I like, we get to see the rifleman. They have a rifleman with them. He does the arm flip. We get the arm flip again. We get another rifleman arm flip scene.
Just when you thought we were done with the arm flip, they're back on the menu.
It's sick. We get one more. He does an arm flip and he just starts blasting, right? And just explodes one of the hovercraft. However, his hover buddies do get their vengeance for their friend because they immediately set off the AC ammo and the rifleman explodes.
Excuse me, sir. Did you say hover buddies?
Yeah.
I love hover buddies.
Oh, then, you know, Alana's just watching all of this just like circle the drain, right? It is at this point that the Otzel pilot calls in to report that she doesn't have any back armor left. And she's just like, oh my God. Oh my God, like how could
they're getting completely enveloped, right? These guys just they're outmaneuvering them in every way.
There's just no way to make this fight look good on a report. It's
no.
It's like the amount of money that's being lost in mechs here versus how much they spent on these five Savannah Masters is probably a very different number.
I love this. You can only describe this section as like the Savannah Master horror scene.
Yeah.
Right. From like Warrior Coupe, you're like, oh, the book with like the Savannah Master horror scene. This is like the scariest thing we've seen so far. Like nothing strikes heart. I'm like, forget everything, dude. Just bring a bunch of Savannah Masters.
We'll have to add it to the things Mech Warrior fears list. It's like number one, Inferno Rockets. Number two, a swarm of Savannah Masters.
Yes, dude. Imagine if they were loaded with Inferno Rockets. Imagine a company of Savannah Masters, like loaded with Infernos, right?
It's, oh, man. Well, do I have some hovercrafts for you? More on that later.
I'm excited.
Remember I was talking about that the things that are important, shoot, move, and communicate, right? So they're kind of failing in the maneuver category. But then about this time, Alana radios into a company command frequency, right? So she's talking to Hire, trying to figure out if she can get some support. And that's what's real neat. There's no support.
Yeah. You know what's really scary about this part is that the hovercraft, like, withdraw, right when they're just cutting them apart and she's like, everyone's starting to panic. They just all disappear all of a sudden. And there's like a moment of silence, right? You get a real, like, I don't like this kind of vibe. It's so cool, right? And yes, and that's when, like you said, she's like, can we get some support? And they're like, there ain't no support. It's so funny. Oh, right. Because some captain from Deuce Battalion is on the radio, right? And he's calling for support. And she's like, Captain who? Where's the colonel? And it's like the guy's just like, he got infernoed, ma'am. Like, burned him alive in his cockpit. And you're like, oh, no. She's just like, congratulations on the promotion. But unfortunately, we don't have any support. I can't help you. We're dying.
She's like, well, get me to somebody higher up than you. And he radios back and he's like, that's me. I'm what's left. Yeah. I'm in charge now. And I hate this.
Yeah, the colonel got infernoed. I hate when that happens.
So there's a breakdown in leadership. They've been outmaneuvered. Now the enemy's retracted, which obviously means that they're up to something even worse if they just gave in after they were already winning. So I'm sure they'll be fine.
Oh, I like this next part. Okay, so this is where the dude in the Ostrock, right? She's like, hey, go check over the hill. Can I get a visual on something? Like, can you just get a little peek over there and tell me what's going on? Dude goes to get a peek and immediately gets one hit by something. He gets obliterated. The Ostrock gets like destroyed. He's
just
like, I'm
clapped.
Just gonna get a peek. Yeah. Boom! And like, he's gone. And you're like, what happened? Well, it turns out right before he died, he called in two Saladins on the other side of the hill.
So the Saladins, they're pretty scary. Again, hovercraft, though those medium lasers, they're real efficient, but you know what's real scary? A fast-moving Class 20 autocannon. They're a hovercraft carrying a good old-fashioned AC-20, specifically a...
Is it a Pontiac?
It's a Scarborough original 20 autocannon.
Shoot.
Isn't that a cool
Scarb, dude.
Name? He's got the Scarborough. Yeah, I was
Scarb
like,
20.
Heck yeah, dude.
Damn, dude.
The Scarb 20.
He clapped him. He did. Yeah.
It's a 200 millimeter autocannon, which is, that's a big boy. Yeah, that's mounted on the old hovercraft. And that's why our boy in the Ostrock just got laid waste to. He saw one up close.
These are cool. There's not any like plastic versions of these, are there?
Nick.
Not yet. Yeah, I don't really know a lot about this one. That's why I was, heck yeah, dude, Saladins. All right, they're on the other side. And this is where Alana realizes that, you know, someone's like, listen, McCarran's armored cavalry is here, right? The Big Mac. And she's like, oh no, that explains everything, right? Because she is like, why are they so good? You know, she's like, that's suspicious. I thought this is supposed to be militia. Why are they operating with surgical efficiency? It's because it's one of the best Capellan units and they hate us specifically. They specifically hate us and are very excited to kill as many of us as possible. Wow, you know, what are the chances?
And in hindsight, it really does feel personal, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. We're talking big time snafu here. Some mouthing idiot stuck her head in the corrupt part's mouth, and I'm not having anything to do with it.
Oh, man, we haven't been able to mark her in a mouthing in some time.
I had this highlighted. For the second I read it, I was like, oh, we're back, boys.
You know, I thought our days of mouthing were behind us, but here we are. Stackpole brought one in just for you, Aaron.
Just for me. It's mouthing time.
The mouth hunter, I call him.
It's not just any mouthing. It's mouthing idiot, yeah. Which is a classic.
That's cream of the crop mouthing right there.
That's right. That's top shelf stuff right there, folks.
Yeah, so it's at this point that Captain Dama realizes this whole thing's a wash. At this point, we're talking survival. We have to, we got to go, right? This isn't, we're leaving. I know we just got here, but it isn't, we're actually, this wasn't our stop. You know, this like she's like, this ain't it, Chief.
Yeah.
Please. Yeah, so I'll tell you what, we're just going to burn the forest and run. That's the end of the chapter. It's just like, start torching. We got to go. God, this rules. I love this scene, actually. This is a cool battle scene because it's just horrific. Just, they just take losses.
Well, it's cool. I feel like we haven't had a scene like this since the Grey Death Legion where we're on the wrong side of an ambush, right?
Yeah.
Most of these have been at least from the perspective of the reader, most of these have been W's. It's our first big L, as the kids say.
Yeah. Yeah. We haven't seen the Davion forces take a huge hit yet. We've seen some skirmishes. A lot of it we've just heard about, like, we could have done better here. But all in all, it's still fine. And
at least on screen anyway, yeah. Right? As far as like what's been text in a novel.
And this is drawn out a whole chapter that is just a one-sided battle where it is just loss after loss. Nothing good happens for anyone in this unit.
It's a blowout, right?
It's funny too. It's all support units. They don't even hit them with the big guns.
No.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We don't even see Big Mac pulling out the mechs.
Yeah, it's five Savannah Masters and two Saladins. So yeah, seven support units.
And they completely destroyed the 5th Surtis Fusiliers. Like, yeah, there's something to be learned here.
Yes, don't land your dropship in a swamp.
Yeah.
You know, this is actually not the first time we've covered this, actually. There was a bad case of Swamp Panthers, if I recall, a few books back. And they also, while they at least were smart enough to not fight in the swamp, they did live in the swamp, which, you know.
And they also died in the swamp.
So, obviously, I'm sure that there's planets out there that the only biome there is swamplands. And you know what? Maybe we don't need to take those planets.
Skip those.
Skip those ones. And if you have any choice about it, don't plant your ass in a swamp. You can put it in there with don't fight in the basement.
You can also chalk up there, don't be a unit that Hans Davian's concerned about.
Yeah, what are the chances? That's crazy.
Yeah. It's some coincidence, that's for sure.
I'd like to see that meeting between Hans and Quintus here. Of the like, well, I think we know what happened.
My hands were tied, Quintus. Yeah, yes. I had to send someone.
And I didn't like these.
However, that meeting occurs on chapter 19. Which will be in the next episode.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Excuse me. Yes.
Don't worry.
Oh, that's so funny. I didn't know that was a meeting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You haven't read ahead.
Yeah.
No, he hasn't. He hasn't.
I'm so excited that we're going to get that conversation now.
He's about to get, he gets exactly what he wanted. Yeah.
It's so funny. I thought you were just being me and you were spoiling something.
Yeah, exactly. Mike knows what you want.
So we had this horror story, but remember, we're on Sarna, and we are overdue. There is a Mindo somewhere that is just losing her mind because no one's acting fast enough for her. She wants an interdiction, and I bet we're going to hear about it pretty soon.
And we'll have to find out who Mindo ropes into a meeting to talk about that interdiction next chapter.
Chapter 18. We're back on Terra, and it's a Comstar chapter. All right. You knew it was coming. We all knew it was coming, right?
Yeah, we had an attack on Sarna. You knew the next chapter was going to be Comstar.
Comstar, First Circuit Compound. It is the 29th of May, 3029. Mindo Waterly has once again called a meeting.
I wonder what she wants.
Yeah, surprising no one, right? We open with the shot of her standing in the Primus's chambers, looking very pleased with herself, right? And, you know, I think we all know why. You know, what a cursed timeline where, like, Mindo was right. You hate, it's like the worst person you know made a good point. Man, you hate to see it. So, well, as we all know, Davian troops have landed on Sarna. And, of course, Mindo is calling for an interdiction. Right? We knew this was coming, okay? No one's surprised. Oh, so I love how they immediately try to cut her off by pointing out that the invasion of Sarna is actually not yet complete. They're like, well, hold on now. They didn't actually finish conquering it yet. So did we? And she's like, what?
Mindo's ready, though.
They took one final shot to be like, maybe we don't give her her way here. One chance. But as Brent said, she came into this meeting ready to throw down.
She did. Yeah, they immediately come at her like, oh, well,
you hypocritical fools, we agreed that an attack on Sarna would trigger an interdiction.
Now, I think it's so funny that they immediately open with, they're not done yet. We didn't. And she's like, you didn't stipulate. That's true. They didn't. I don't think that. Look, I didn't check. But yeah, that's like you realize that they're desperate now, right? They're just grasping. This, you know, this, of course, enrages Precentor Dieron. Mendo points out that to her credit, she actually waited for Davian troops to actually land on Sarna before calling the meeting. She's like, I actually waited for them to make landfall specifically so that she could avoid this line of questioning, right? She did try to get in front of it.
Yeah, and then they hit her with, you remember that footage of the Davian troops attacking an APG station that we were trying to manufacture? Like, they're not even in that area yet. So if we, like, disrupt everything, our video is going to look pretty fake at that point.
Right, yes. If they interdicted right now, it would kind of get in the way of their whole false flag attack.
Yeah, exactly. The part where, so Precentor Tharkad points out that he's like, remember that false flag video we made? We talked about it, right? We produced that false footage implicating Davian troops in some kind of violent invasion. It's so funny. I was like, oh yeah, the false flag video. I forgot for a moment. Honestly, I was like, right. How could I forget about the false flag? He points out that, you know, the problem is that that footage doesn't actually take place where the Davian troops landed, right? So it would be like very suspicious to release the video since like Davian troops have yet to even attack that location, right?
Yeah, not a lot of HPGs in Swamplands.
Yeah, so I guess they shot it on Sarna, or they did a recreation of a set, but that's funny. It's like, man, we picked the wrong location. They're not even there. Just don't use the video. I don't know. Listen. So now this is where Precentor Sion points out that the Davian forces don't actually appear to be on their way to conquering Sarna at all, right? They're actually not doing that well. You know, see last chapter. Remember, it's actually there, you know, there's nothing leading us to believe that they're actually going to take Sarna. However, they did attack it. I believe that was what the agreement was. Oh, right. He points out that, you see, because the Davian troops are actually getting crushed on Sarna, that what we really want is for, like, news of their defeat to spread throughout the realm. Right? That's, we don't want to cut off the news. People need to hear about this triumphant, if we like interdict them, then they won't, people back home won't get this morale. He's trying, right? He's trying his best. They're all reaching for anything, really. They're desperate.
Which, for a moment, I think we should talk about, why do you think it is that they are so desperate to not interdict House Davian? I certainly have reasons that I suspect, but I was curious what you gentlemen thought.
Well, in our previous Comstar chapters, when they first started talking about interdiction, specifically, the Primus was hesitant to go along with this because he states, by us doing an interdiction in the middle of a war without just cause, we're showing favoritism, or at least something that can be seen as favoritism. And then our whole, we're just the phone company bit no longer plays good.
Yeah.
They'll see us as somebody that's swayed one side or the other. And that means all the houses will start looking at us skeptically instead of just your friendly phone company.
Right. The attention's not good.
Yeah.
Yeah. They must maintain the facade of impartiality. Or, I mean, I guess it's, they are kind of like impartial, right? I mean, they are, I mean, they haven't, at least for a while, they're always doing stuff, but they've never actively helped one. I mean, like, you know, assisted a house in the invasion of, you know, that's their whole thing. They're shadowy. They just want to read the mail. That's their bread and butter. They don't want to, you know, keep that mail going, right? Am I right?
Well, it seems like Comstar's actions benefit Comstar.
Well, hold up. There is some, we've read about, well, at least a small section of Comstar who was definitely working with elements of the Free Worlds League.
Oh, you mean the rebel forces that Davian's funding?
No, I'm talking about HAL Memory Corps.
Oh, sorry.
Mind you, it was to their own ends, but that's just it. They will assist a great house if it means they can get what they want. Unless you're Mendo Waterly, and then you're just really trying to look out for the Draconis Combine.
Yes. Which, to Comstar's credit as a whole here, there was a moment during the wedding when they talked about interdicting the Capellan space.
Yes.
And they said, like, no, if we do that, it's just doom for the Capellans. So we're going to stay our hand here. And that was argued from Mendo's perspective on that, of saying, like, we can't do that because it'll help one house over another in a conflict that doesn't really benefit us. And now it seems like
that script and her argument has been flipped of like, I've wanted an interdiction on Davian and there is no compromise I'm willing to give unless we interdict.
That being said, what about Mindo Waterly's perspective here? Is Hans Davion not more or less winning this war so far? I mean, he's clearly having some trouble on Sarna.
Oh, yeah. No, he's crushing it, bro. He's killing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, does she have a point? Is it necessary here? I think the point I'm trying to make here is I actually think this dialogue is Comstar working as needed. The gears in Comstar are actually working flawlessly. Yes, Mindo has ulterior motives, but it also seems like Comstar is being a little slow to act here if they are trying to keep the successor states kind of at bay.
Well, and to argue that point from Team Tiepolo's playbook, I would say he always runs on the idea of subtlety. We've heard him bring that up thousands of times at this point. And an interdiction is the opposite of that. That is a direct declaration against the Davion House without reason to interdict them.
Oh, right. Is Tiepolo overly cautious? Does he stay his hand when he should strike?
And we've talked about that in his, in what we've seen is he has played a lot of Comstar's actions reactionary. And the problem is, and Brent, to your point on that, reactionary isn't stopping Hans Davian's plans. And they're showing that they aren't very good at predicting his actions at this point.
Which I think Mindo is about to mention here.
Mm-hmm.
This whole next part of this chapter is we get this bit where Mindo like goes around the room and asks everyone why they think Hans Davian started this war in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's like, why do you guys think this is even happening? Like, does anyone want to volunteer? So Precentor Sion goes first. He believes that it is so Hans can fulfill the long-held dream of installing himself as the first lord of a new Star League, right? Everyone knows that one. Everyone wants to be the first lord.
Yeah, just good old-fashioned manifest destiny.
Right.
All right.
The classic. He's doing the Star League thing. Precentor New Avalon and Tharkat, they jump in on it. They say that, well, they always assumed that it was for like economic enrichment, right? It's imperialism is very profitable. That's the whole thing about it. Dude, he's rich. Like Tikhonov, do you know how much Tikhonov was worth? That's a lot of wealth, right? That is no longer flowing into the House Liao coffers. They're going back to New Avalon, dude. That's money. Okay, so now this is where the Primus himself says how, well, if that's true, then why would Davian attack Sarna, though, right? Because Sarna has very little economic value, right? Its value is mostly symbolic to House Liao. I mean, from their perspective, it's like they assume that it is, in fact, almost certainly this symbolic importance that prompted Liao to station the Big Mac there in the first place. Because, well, remember, Sarna is a regional capital, right? It does have symbolic importance. He's already lost two regional capitals. Remember, we've already lost Tikhonov. And remember, they lost Liao too, right? The Liao family estates. So that was like, that's like two provincial. You know what? The thing is, she asked this question, and honestly, all of these guys give pretty reasonable answers, I thought. Somebody's for like, you know, political influence, various political reasons, joining of realms, and like the other two are like economic enrichment. And you're like, yeah, totally. Unfortunately for the First Circuit, this activates like Mindo's trap card, right? Like this is where she's like, I got him. Apparently she anticipated this because at this point, Mindo goes into a long rant, laying out her case that Hans Davian's motives are neither political or economic. They are personal in nature, right? Basically, she thinks Hans is a hater, okay?
She would.
Yeah. You know, she even brings up the destructions of the Fifth Certus Fusiliers as evidence of Hans's desire to eradicate anyone who could stand against him, right? She's like, you saw what he did to the Fusiliers.
This is great, right? This shows that Mindo is clearly paying attention, right? We've kind of already talked about that it is a little funny that the hand that is overextended by the fox was this unit in particular. And it's clear it hasn't gone unnoticed.
Everyone's like, it's so funny because we said it and then they're saying it. They're like, isn't it weird that it just so happened to be the Fusiliers, right? And you're like, yeah, isn't it though? Everyone's saying it. It wasn't just us. You know what I mean? Yes, it's suspicious.
I imagine the Fusiliers are, what remains of them are thinking the same things themselves.
Yeah, yeah. What are the chances?
This really lends credence to what she's saying, right? That, oh, it does appear that maybe this is some Machiavellian plot.
Right. Basically, Mindo thinks that more than Hans wants to enrich his nation, he wants to hurt Liao, right? It's a grudge. This is like a personal, this is a vendetta, right? He's using the military force of his nation to enforce this like personal vendetta, vengeance quest, right? And she believes that despite Blake's immense wisdom, right? We love Blake, right? We love him. Nothing, I'm not trying to say anything bad about Blake, but he could have never predicted that a head of state could operate his nation in such a manner.
And it was at this moment that she f***ed up.
Yeah.
I feel like she was really starting to move people to her side here. But, Jerome Blake is a deified figure of Comstar. And for those who may have missed this somewhere along the way, he's essentially Comstar Jesus. And
he's Comstar Jesus.
And questioning his quote-unquote wisdom is not far removed from heresy of any other kind of religion.
Isn't this where, that's right, she starts, going off about Blake, and the other precentors are like, whoa, Blake, like, oh, come on, you know, it's like, hey, everyone starts like getting puffy, and she's like, hey, guys, drop the F. She's like, come on, that's what we tell people. But like, guys,
this is the First Circuit.
Yeah. Can we drop it? Well, it's so funny that the last part of her argument here is about how Blake could have never predicted that a madman would end up at the head of a powerful interstellar nation state. And I'm like, he definitely would have considered that, right?
That's very funny. I thought the exact same thing. And I was like, from what little I know about Blake and his
and his word
and his ideas was that the successor states were always going to fight, whether it be for power, money, or personal vendettas. So it seemed like that was the whole premise of Comstar, is like, we're just going to be the ones that balance all that out. And so, yeah, a person running a country and a war based on a personal vendetta in her argument falls directly into with that idea.
It's a, I believe even the great father himself, Alexander Kerensky, is then made to be compared to Fox.
It's just funny because this is the exact type of situation that Jerome Blake would have the most personal experience with. It's like, I guarantee you, he wrote the words about like power hungry madmen enacting personal vendettas.
There's that those men exist, and then there's they can do something about it and have the cunning and the know-how to take that anger and through wisdom and action make it happen. I think it's really kind of a low blow to Blake to say that he couldn't conceptualize that he'd think that these people could exist, but that they couldn't follow through with it. Because, he witnessed it his time.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't this exactly the Amara Civil War that we're talking about right now? This whole concept of a power-hungry madman enacting a war on personal vendetta?
Yeah, yeah. Here's the thing. Hans would totally do that, though. Just to be clear, Hans would absolutely use military force to enforce a personal vendetta.
Oh, yeah. I truly believe that a part of this was literally him having a way to save face and to cut off the part of his realm that was slowly rebelling against him. Yes, I have no doubt that Hans was and is capable. And I'm even going to say he is a comparable tactician to Alexander Kerensky, but they clearly had different goals. And we're different people. Even that comparison, I feel, is it's rough. I feel like this is what I'm saying. Like, up until the moment she opened her mouth about Jerome, I think she had a good argument. And then she She went and made a mud pie with bringing all of this up.
Praise Blake.
So, in spite of all of the gambling on comparisons of holy members of Comstar, they nonetheless concede, and it turns out they're going to give Mindo exactly what she wanted.
Unbelievable, right? Yes, yes. Shockingly, this appears to actually work. I was like, no, not like this. Don't let her have, no. But yes, it is at this point that the other precentors begin legitimately considering an interdiction. She finally did it. So Mindo stabs further by pointing out how an interdiction would certainly disrupt the economy and cause civil unrest within the Federated Suns, right? A little cherry on top. She's like, did you think about that? What about the economic disruption, huh? Civil unrest. Think about it. And they're all like, we're thinking about it, right? And you're like, no, no. Now, oh my God, like the Primus himself gets in on it when he points out that he's like, oh, right, interdicting House Davian will cause his allies in the Lyran Commonwealth to question their alliance and disrupt the flow of resources to the rebellions inside the Free Worlds League. We didn't forget about those. Remember, Hans, as he's sponsoring all those within the Free Worlds League. The Fox, right? Right? Like, everyone's like, huh, you know, maybe she's onto something. You know, maybe, I don't know, he's got a point. And you're like, oh no, this is happening, right? I mean, Mindo, practically beaming at this point, calls for a vote, which passes unanimously. House Davian will be interdicted. It happened. She did it.
So, who here thinks the Fox predicted this?
Well, I jump back to the thought of the wedding and how Hans had full systems in place to work around Comstar, to keep them out of the loop as possible. The way he had measures in place to pass messages and to have discussions that Comstar could not spy on. And from what we have seen in this offensive, one of the major elements that's been missing is the use of Comstar from the Davian forces for coordination, a lot of these things. Now, of course, I'm not saying that it wasn't there. I'm sure they're using it. But it wasn't brought up as a major point how they were relying on this to succeed. And I would also think his actions at the wedding were very spiteful towards Comstar. He had them hold the wedding and announce the war at their home base.
Totally. Yeah, it's very disrespectful.
So I don't disagree with anything you're saying. However, the question I asked is, did Hans Davion predict this interdiction? Now, what you're saying is he prepared for dubious outcomes, right? He did his due diligence to be able to work without Comstar, which you could argue is evidence that he predicted an interdiction at some point. But I mean, this interdiction...
I don't think that he thought that Sarna was the interdiction trigger. No, like he was not aware of that, to my knowledge. Like, I like what you said about, you were like, did he just prepared for dubious outcomes, like you said, and he had workarounds in place. But this specific, did he think that? No, probably not.
So you don't think that he predicted this would be a cause for interdiction?
I bet it was a higher likelihood, right? I bet Quintus on the file. I bet he has a little box that's like likelihood of interdiction. This one was like, he was like, this one's like a 15. It's all considered, right?
Right.
It has to be. Yeah. Did they think it was possible? Sure. Did they assume that attacking Sarna would trigger an interdiction? No, I don't think so.
I would say the action on Sarna, probably not. But I would put it as a likelihood that this fifth wave of attacks would be a point that they may have considered as a strong possibility. Just because after partially absorbing the Tikhonov region, there isn't a lot of reason to keep pushing into Capellan space aggressively on the Davian side. So this would just continue on saying, oh, we're going to keep going. We're not stopping. And if there was going to be a counterbalance action done by Comstar that Hans has done nothing to prevent from happening, he hasn't tried to do anything to curry favor with Comstar, that this could be that point of action being taken, but not necessarily specifically on Sarna itself.
So basically, what I've got from both of you is no. You don't think that this, Sarna in particular, was predicted to be the point of interdiction by the fox. Both of you said that he likely predicted it would be soon, but not necessarily directly here.
Yeah.
I don't have a leg in the race. I just thought it would be an interesting thought experiment because I actually kind of lean towards that he did know somehow, that maybe he's got someone in there. Maybe not talking to Hans directly, but maybe talking to Mr. Allard. But who knows?
Oh, you think Comstar's compromised? You think he's got a man inside?
I think it's possible. Any organization can be infiltrated.
Yeah, I mean, they accept hires, right? They have, like, adepts. I think you can, like, apply. I bet that there's more houseplants in the rank and file than there is actual, like, just, you know, just, oh, I'll just sign up for... It's like... Heck yeah, dude. I bet they're all up in there. I guarantee it. Good point. Every janitor. Yeah.
Now, in order to have this information in particular, he might have to have someone in the First Circuit itself, which that's a little bit more impressive. But I digress. Like I said, I just thought it would be an interesting discussion.
But in the realm of predictions, when I read this chapter, the thing I felt the most and the person who would lose the most from this felt like it was going to be Primus Tiepolo. I felt like up to this point, he's been in control of what's going on in the First Circuit. He's been able to bat away Mendo. He's been able to turn the First Circuit against her ideas. But that idea of neutrality seems to permeate in him to the point where he does let things happen that he probably shouldn't. Who does not feel that draw towards neutrality, who feels very power hungry in this organization, this is that slipping point that they can take advantage of.
Tiepolo is too reactionary, I think. But, you know, I also don't think that Mendo's the answer to Tiepolo's kind of slow resolve. We've talked about this previously, but Mendo is kind of on the other extreme, where she's almost exclusively action-oriented, and she has motives that are clearly not in Comstar's interests.
Well, and she's shown that she's gunning for Tiepolo.
Yes.
Throughout all the final thought she has is about, I'm going to take you down, where Tiepolo feels like he's trying to just keep things rolling.
He's trying to keep things as they are, right? He's trying to maintain the status quo. So what you're saying is that this is the beginning of an inevitable coup of Tiepolo. Is that what you're saying?
The beginning of the fall of Tiepolo and the rise of Mendo.
Interesting. We'll have to see.
Waterly, she's not your friend, though.
But she is Mendo.
Well, we'll just have to see how all this plays out when we come back next week to continue on in the book we've been working through, Warrior Coupe.
This was another episode of Mechs and Men. I am Kanan Hill, joined as usual by my good friends Brent and Aaron. As always, we would like to thank the author, Michael A. Stackpole, and all the other writers and artists who work so hard to keep Battletech alive. We would like to thank Catalyst Game Labs for being such generous stewards of the property. We have an email, advice@heat.management. If you have any questions, corrections, suggestions, please, advice@heat.management.
We actually have a correction, kind of, and I'm going to talk about this again in the remembrance. It's a light correction, but we did, in a previous episode, we alluded to, or it sounded like we alluded to, the Needler's munitions were metal flechettes, because we alluded to them being like the weapons of Mass Effect, but they are in fact a polymer composite. And just wanted to make sure we set the record straight.
Not metal, not ceramic either. Crucially, you said polymer composite, right?
Yes.
But it does, but it's, you know, it's like a little brick and it like shaves off little pieces of it.
And that's why we drew the Mass Effect comparison, yes. But it is not a block of metal. It is indeed a block of polymer composite.
We're on social media, Instagram, Twitter, at Of Mechs and Men.
We also are on the Valhalla Club Discord. We have a booth there, and it's probably the easiest place you can usually directly reach us. And you'll often find us on Friday nights, usually me or sometimes Aaron playing Mech Warrior Online or lately Helldivers. So if that's something you'd be into, come hang out with us on the Valhalla Club Discord. The link is in the description.
Also, if you can, leave a rating or a review, please. Thank you. And thank you for listening. We will return next week to continue our discussion of Warrior Coupe by Michael A. Stackpole. Until then.
Until next time.
Selah.